from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Lincoln Rush.
Now, as you may notice, this is a weird name for any of you who are listeners of the podcast. You're wondering, where is Ryan? Where's Carissa? Where's maybe Jeff? Although some of you were like, who the fuck is Jeff? That's a different podcast altogether. But today I have a very special guest who has, as a school project, if you can believe this is a school project, has decided that he's going to interview me because apparently what I do is a job. And now I have to kind of describe what it is that I do and give embarrassing information about, you know, financial things. But I figured, hey, this would make an interesting bonus show. And, of course, just because I'm slowly taking everybody off their crack, I decided that I was going to actually make this one a freebie so that anybody who's just sort of like, it's like a general reminder, would be like, no, it's all good. But then you're still going to have to pay for it. Yeah, that's how it is. I'm comparing myself to drugs. I'm a positive role model. So with that in mind, Lincoln Rush, my special guest, is from Humboldt. Am I pronouncing this right?
Humboldt.
Which is a town in Iowa. Population, you can count on one hand. Well, no, not quite. About 5,000, you said, you told me?
Yep.
All right, it's not a very big place. And apparently there's a high school there. And now I want you to explain to the nice audience what exactly is this school project you have?
Well, it's a graduation requirement that we have to do. Every kid has to do it. And you just pick a job that you might want to do in the future, one that might be profitable. And I don't know why I picked you then. But and you just follow them around for a day and ask them some questions and all that.
Well, you know, at first you were even talking about coming down, which I have to first of all tell you that would be a very bad idea because although, you know, my country is very beautiful, it's more like picturesque in a way that, you know, something looks good on a painting, but not necessarily when you're living in the winter wonderland. I'm like, I don't know if you are ready. I mean, I know you have occasional, if snowfall in Iowa.
Yeah,
but I don't think you have the kind of cold, nightmarish cold we have. I'm not. Am I wrong here? Do you have cold days?
I think last year we had about 5 inches of snow on the ground for 3 straight weeks or something.
Shocking. Well, you know that's a good day of snowfall where I'm from. So and you know what? Although we've had the benefits, I don't even want to know if I want to use that word. Of global warming recently with this insane weather that just popped out of nowhere, slapped me in the face with spring, and then said, see ya. See ya, motherfucker. So your project is designed for what exactly? I'm trying to figure out, why does the school want you to do this?
I don't know. They must think it prepares us for something.
All right. Well, I mean, I... It's funny that you mentioned this because last show, which you have not heard yet because I have not put it up, but last show I talked about a letter that I got from a very young fan who's asking me, like, hey, what school should I go to? I'm confused about the future. And the funny thing is, I mean, I really had no advice to give her other than the fact that I am terrified for your generation because, you know, right at the time where I left is when the crazy debt thing started to just pile up like madness. Like, I have debt, but I don't have debt like an American student graduating has debt. Like, they have debt like, I just bought a house debt. And then they're like, I don't have a job. Oh, I see. So, you know, this is going to be a very interesting show because, in a sense, I'm so anti-establishment. Then in a way, no knowing professor should have ever given you, the okay to do this. And with that in mind, I want to answer lots of your fucking interesting questions that you've compiled. Unfortunately, we were unsuccessful in trying to get you to get many of the other members of the site to participate in general list of questions, you know, because I felt, sure, everybody who wants to know something, go ahead. When have I ever not told the truth? I don't know, because you're a new listener. There is an episode where I tell everybody what my grades are when I graduated high school. Wow. That was I don't know if I can tell you how bad those were. All right. Well, hopefully we're not going to give you a bad grade. So let's run through these questions here, because there's a gamut that you want me to run through, right?
Yep. And there's about 23 questions in here.
Okay, 23 questions. We're going to try to deal with it with as much finesse as possible. All right, question number one. Lay it on me, brother.
What are the entry-level requirements for this job? A microphone?
Okay, well, you know, here's the surprising thing. Like, when you do what I do, at first you could say, yeah, you just pick up a microphone and then you just do it. With the same way that you could say, if you write a book, you just take a typewriter and you write a book. Yes, of course, everyone can do it, which is, I think, the reason why so few people actually do, because the sheer fact of doing it can seem daunting at times. I mean, yeah, sure, you're picking up a microphone, you're talking into it, but when you're not sure if anybody's listening, the words sometimes can be hard to find. And the hilarious thing about it is the one thing that I have noticed from at least what it is that I do is it's impossible to have anyone listen unless there's some part of what you do that's genuine. Like, you can't be fake, you know? Like, people detect that easily. And we're prone to, like, really a lot of hatred of fakeness. So, I mean, if you were to say, well, what are the pre-requirements of what you do? It's like, well, imagine that you needed to have something that you felt so genuine about that you could talk about it even though sometimes you just couldn't give a fucking rat's ass about it. You know what I mean? Like, just the days where you're like, I don't want to fucking do this. Fuck atheism. Fuck everything. You know, that happens, okay? It happens in any job anyways. The people that persevere are the ones that are just like, I'm just going to keep doing it.
Fighting for a lost cause at my high school. Everyone's just got their head in the Bible all day.
Well, I mean, you know, at the same time, like, you think about what is perseverance, right? Well, I mean, that's I think that really is generally the requirement that I say is first thing you have to have, perseverance, because when you think that you're down is just when things are getting warmed up. Like, I remember when I came back from the Reason Rally, like, I am a bad traveler. Everybody who's ever met me will tell you that Jacob Forte does not ride well anywhere. You know, like, I can't sit still for more than, you know, 3 or 4 hours, and then I go fucking nuts. Like, I just need to move a little bit. And unfortunately, I have one of those frames where at 6'1", I'm just tall enough that everything is unpleasant. You know, where every designer was like, no man shall ever be more than 6 and a little, because that is obviously the height of mankind's tallness. It will never be higher. And meanwhile, you're like, oh, I mean, I can't. I'm complaining here, but I mean, I can't imagine what, say, like, Graydon Square is, like, 6'4", giant monster that he is, but fucking how he travels. But meanwhile, I have my own demons, and I was on the bus. I had to go from Washington to Montreal, which means that Washington goes to New York, and that's roughly 7 hours, and then from New York to Montreal is roughly 7 hours if everything goes well. The thing is, when the Washington bus arrived in New York, I was done. You know what I mean? Like, just at the point where you're like, I can't do it. I don't want to face another 7 hours of just sitting there being bored to death while I can't fall asleep.
Yeah, we went on one vacation. That was from Iowa, and we drove to Virginia Beach, and then we drove through New York and all the way back to Iowa. We were in the car the whole time.
How many hours is that?
I don't know. It was the same thing.
Is it more than 15?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, my goodness. But, like, I think at the point where you feel done, like, imagine, I don't know if you've ever watched mixed martial arts before. Have you ever watched? No? Anyways, it's ultimate fighting. It's just people boxing. And the one thing is, once in a while when you watch people do that, you realize that there are points where a guy's getting punched in the face where you're like, how can he still be alive? And then he throws his own, like, punches. Like, he finds a second wind. It's a thing that people often talk about. Like, it's not well understood, but it's well known to those few who've ever experienced it, where just given a certain kind of crisis, When you thought you were over that edge, you find something, you know, you find some other bit of reserve, the real secret reserve that your body's like, no, you can't touch it until things really fucking fall and times are bad. And I think that that's where, you know, like trying to push through enough to find that second reserve, like the second win of what you do, that's the hardest part. That's the part where, I mean, I can't tell you how many people, very, very talented people, people that are way more talented than me, that at just one point were like, I can't do this anymore. It's too embarrassing. It's too fucking demeaning. I hate what I do, which is a feeling that everybody has at one point in their lives. They fucking hate it, even if they, you know, secretly love it. They will just, they'll resent it. They'll resent it because of what it means. You were, you know, like, I think every human being wants to be a free spirit. And even something that you love is fucking chain, shackles. So, I mean, you marry yourself to it, and like any relationship, it goes through some fucking hardships. So the other prerequisite, I would say, is to have a very sophisticated understanding of relationships.
So for number one, I have passion and sophisticated understanding of relationships. In parentheses, it says education, experience, training, etc.
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is that a lot of a relationship, you know, be it with a person or even with a thing, is built largely on experience, right? Like, I can't teach certain things. They have to be experienced. Like, one of the – I was just thinking – I was looking back even at my adolescence, my – you know, my young adulthood, and thinking about all of those moments where I'm just like, oh, God, I wish that moment would have never happened, right? It's just embarrassing, or I don't know. Sometimes it's those moments that sort of really shape you, where you just said, I was so wrong, or I did something so shitty and stupid that I regret it, and it just haunts me. But the thing about those events is that they're so necessary. They're built, you know, your entire personality will be built on your experience of failure and how you deal with that and how that crafts you as a person. And while most people recoil from failure because that's the natural impetus, the truth is you need a lot of it. You know, like you can't draw a straight line until you draw a million fucking crooked ones. And you know, like what I was talking to you about, the threshold is the point where a person who tries to draw that straight line is just basically abandons such a foolish pursuit at one point where he's like, why should I keep doing this? I should just go and work in the farm and tend the cattle and do what my father did, like, and his father did, because they were sane men who passed on their genes. And I am a fucking dreamer who is just, I don't know, plucking ideas out of his head and hoping to make money from it.
And I've written, like, two books now. I think they're both shit, but I've written them. And I can only get better. And that's how I see it.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, like the amount of stuff that I've written over the years that I've never released. I mean, they are the equivalent of that as well. I'm just embarrassed by them, you know. Like as much as I'm embarrassed from some of the things that I've said in the past on other shows where I feel very much, you know, young, foolish, and not educated. I can live with those, you know. They're part of that transition. You're like, I can't be ashamed of all my past, but, you know, am I ashamed of some of my early works? As people who know me well, or who look at the stuff that I do, because I also illustrate quite a bit, they'll know that I mostly I destroy early drawings, will erase them entirely, and draw over them, because I'm ashamed of them. I don't even think about. You know, this line that I messed up or this thing that I did, I would rather draw over it something that I'm satisfied with to change history, you know, like to rewrite it, that I don't have to deal with that horror. But the failure is the part that was the most important and the one where you grew the most. So it's like a really difficult relationship. I mean, I think that I've always been too afraid of my own failures, and maybe that's another prerequisite, is like developing a normal fear of your own failures and an over analysis of it. Finding that balance is very, very tricky.
Yeah, I think. And I say I've written two books, but I've actually written three. The first one was just so bad I don't even like to talk about it. So if anyone asks me, I just say.
And you know what? Like in the future, I mean, what will Lincoln Rush, when he's 32, think about those early works as well, right? Like you may even forget about those. Like I think to myself, what memories have I retained from my early experiences, even from high school? I got to tell you, dude, I don't remember anything. Like as far as if I was you, it would basically be a ghostly existence until my 21st birthday, where things start to coalesce in my mind. And until then, it's a fucking shadow. So in my world, you are living a shadow identity where even your, you know, like the very chemistry of your brain hasn't even set itself. Your ability to form memories and patterns is highly compromised.
Yeah. I think 3 years ago I made this one PowerPoint just for fun. It was about Christmas. And I was really religious back then. I was like, thank God for Jesus and Christmas and not Santa for presents. And at the end I said, no atheists allowed on it or something. And now I look back on that, I'm ashamed.
Well, it's part of those experiences, you know, like where how could you have known better? I mean, you can be ashamed, but at the same time, I mean, like, I think part of looking at your past and owing up to those shames is owing up to the parts of us that are the real causes of that type of ignorance or arrogance, right? Like, I was arrogant in my past because I was masking a secret fear of my own intellectual inferiority. Like, I have graduated from no university. And my whole life I wanted to be taken seriously as a thinker. But, you know, I refused to pursue the career path that laid in front of me. I'm like, I don't really feel that is the way that I work and learn. For me, it's not a matter of going to school to learn. For me, it's like that's what I do for fun. People will see me, like, browsing and cataloging and just, ooh, I learned a new fact today. You know, like the whole reason I do Good Atheist is that it's literally a way for me to try to get people to pay me money to read and research. I view myself as a modern day Stoic. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Stoics in ancient Greeks, the ancient Greek Stoics. Are you familiar?
No, we don't learn anything in school.
Okay, well let me give you a free lesson on Stoics because they're interesting. Basically, in ancient Greece. There were guys that used to go around and basically teach you the art of rhetoric. Now, rhetoric is where I will teach you an argument, but really, it's just a clever way to mask something that's just wrong. You know, you ever meet someone who's able to win an argument, but you know clearly they're wrong, you just can't rebuke them? Okay, that's what early Stoics used to do. They were being paid because, I mean, if I went over to you and I said, I could help you win every argument that you have with the dummies around you that have absolutely no idea what a rhetoric is. Like, they've never actually faced. This is a new idea. We've just tapped into it, and it's secret fucking knowledge. I mean, to give you an idea of how secretive knowledge used to be and how much you take it for granted that it's all out there, you ever heard of Pythagoras? Okay, well, when you were in Pythagoras' little cult, if you spilled the beans about the theorem, they would kill you. So, I mean, that's a different world, right? Where I could just throw the Pythagorean theorem at you, and you might just dismiss it as being unimportant, where there was a time where that would get you killed, and that was not that long ago, respective to everything else. But yes, so the Stoics used to just go around. They were like the poor man's philosopher, if you want, like not really producing any original material, just, you know, providing a very lucrative service of teaching an argument, which, I mean, in a sense is what I do. I can't proclaim to be any more enlightened than some poor man Stoic because, in a sense, I have no recognized form of credentials that would allow me to do that. And I'm not an accredited teacher, although judging by the fact that you're, what, 17 now? 15? Okay, thank God. But 15 and not knowing what a fucking Stoic is. I mean, you live in America. If you go to Washington, you've seen the architecture. I mean, your founding fathers used to practically worship the Greeks, and you have no idea what a Stoic is. You know, like, this is a sad day.
I think we're just taking Greek society and making it American. You know, democracy is ours.
Well, that, I mean, I suppose that's, if you want to look at any successful society, here's another, you know, sort of culture you've probably never heard of, the ancient Akkadians. And they were one of the earliest societies, right? Like they were, I mean, to give you an idea of how early this society is, imagine that in one of the birthplaces of civilization, which is, you know, like the Tigris and Euphrates, you've heard of these two rivers, right?
Yeah, we're doing that right now.
Right now, good, excellent. Now, along those two rivers, like most places which are the birthplaces of civilizations, I mean, you need water, right? That's the whole trip. I mean, we're nothing but sea sponges, glorified fucking sea sponges that are dependent on H2O for their maintenance. But, you know, let's not get carried away. We need some fucking water all the time.
No, Jacob, remember, we're God's creation, and he loves us.
Now, you're on my timetable. Not theirs. But, yeah, so in and around that time, the first civilization that we have really some writing and some understanding of is the Sumerians. And they're really a civilization, like a patchwork of cities. You know, you have a couple like Uruk and Ur and those kinds of places. And what happens later is that these other guys called Akkadians sort of, they also have their city-states or whatever, and they're pretty much emulating the Sumerians, because who isn't? I mean, the motherfuckers invented cuneiform writing and, like, the wheel, and they also had, like, really useful things like primitive math and shit. I mean, that was the bomb, right? You're just like, wow, look at them. They've got things that are circular and move heavy objects without much effort. These guys are awesome. I mean, we got to be fair, right? In the context of where all these ideas are new, not taken for granted, or perhaps even deadly, to know that information, you know, it can seem impressive to be able to be so organized. So the Akkadians essentially just kind of take what these guys did, take it for their own, and just kind of move into the place, really. And they're like, it's ours now because you motherfuckers are totally disorganized and weak. So, I mean, the ability to rewrite your own history is kind of a useful thing. So, I mean, let's just say that was always the great capacity of your country. It was always the ability to amalgamate ideas, claim it as their own, and sort of like repackage it in that really sexy American brand, you know?
Everything's marketable.
I mean, who in the history of civilization has sold food or like a burger as well as your country, if you want to give yourself any credit?
Well, yeah, we can sell anything. That's really what we do.
Well, unfortunately, one of the things that your country is quite good at is selling God. And you know, a lot of that is subsidized by your tax dollars. I don't know if you've had that. I covered it in the past. Hopefully you haven't had this horrible thing of a guy called Bradley Dean and his whole You Can Run But You Can't Hide ministries. And they get money. These are evangelical fundamentalists who get paid by the government through abstinence programs. So, I mean, you live in a world, in a society in which, yeah, that's being sold to you officially, or at least unofficially by the government through these programs that they've approved of. And I'm like, you're facing a tough battle, man. I don't know. How is it in Iowa, by the way? Like, you're obviously in the closet, right? Like, about this
Yeah.
shit.
Well, I mean, not really, but I got into an argument in mythology class about all this. And I was saying the Greek myths are kind of like Christianity. And they started saying, yeah, but, you know, Christianity is true. And I got into this argument with, like, 15 other people against me. And that was no fun.
You could probably feel their fucking hatred in their eyes.
Yeah, some stupid girl, she said, I think every word in the Bible is true. And no one considered that, except for me.
Well, you know what, I suppose in a sense, I mean, I guessed your age wrong before, just because I was trying to gauge your age based on your comprehension. Although, you know, I say 17, but honestly, your comprehension is where mine was when I was like maybe 21. Like, I really still don't get it. Like, if you guys are that smart, how stupid am I? Like, I'm 32 and I'm going to be moron by the time you guys are 32. I feel like you have a crazy head start on me. Like, how can you understand everything that I say?
Well, you think how much time we spend on math and other dumb subjects like that that we don't need unless you're going into a specific field. We're not actually that smart.
But your comprehension is obviously good. I mean, like, why else would you like the show? Has there been things that I've said during the show that you did not understand? Okay, but and this is what you have to kind of grasp. I know that people always say, but like, Jacob, you're the common man. Look, I use common man language, but the subject matter that I deal with is not common man shit, all right? This is highly intellectual stuff, and it's being grasped by like a 15-year-old, no problem. I'm like, you are not an idiot, sir. It's like, obviously, there's a large problem, a very large problem, which is the way that you're being taught. Like, I feel an infinite amount of sadness, or perhaps a sense of responsibility of rectifying this particular situation in my own way. Like, I don't know if you do this, but you know, do you go on the blog? Do you follow links of what I put? Like, do you read the books that I recommend? Are these things that you do?
No, I've only been with you for a month. I've only listened to the show. That's it.
Okay, well, you know, you're a tough demographic to break through. It's like, I've only had you for a month, but I feel like I need to show you so much more because, I mean, you're already far enough ahead that the things that are required for you to learn should not be that great of an effort to teach you. Honestly, no. It saddens me the fact that we are in such a situation where that's true. And, you know, I even wonder, like, perhaps is this the irony of your exam, which we should continue, by the way. We should work with question two because I feel like I've been ranting. All right, fair enough. Okay, let's deal with question two, sir. Question number two.
Where did you receive your education or training? Name of college, university, or
Well, you know what? I went to high school in a place called Alexander Galt. And you know what, like, apart from the fact that it had a fenced-in wall with barbed wire on the inside, it was actually a really friendly place. There was
concentration camp?
You know, I felt like that from the outside. I always wondered, you know, it was hilarious because those kinds of fences are stupid. If you're a kid and you want to escape, why would you climb it? You would just find a way to cut through. Like, who wouldn't want to go through barbed wire? That's stupid. You're just inviting someone to cut your fence rather than to just jump over. But, you know, never mind the short-sightedness of some adults. The place, you know, like, all I came from a small town myself. I mean, Lennoxville is an English place amongst a French province. So a rarity. Like, imagine it's kind of similar in certain areas of Italy, in fact, where northern parts of Italy speak French, despite the fact that they're Italian. And, you know, some southern parts of France can speak Italian despite being French. You know, like, there's a lot of – the borders are not always drawn perfectly.
Yeah. This just surprises me how not diverse Iowa is. I mean, we have 20 black people, and it's 20 adopted kids in one family. It's ridiculous.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it
no.
Is.
Oh, no. Okay, that's a lot of sameness. But, you know, we had a couple – of black people in our high school. Actually, it's funny because one of my very close friends, you know, who I was staying with in Dominican Republic, he was also adopted, and that was also unfortunately one of the lack of diversities where I was from as well. So we didn't have a lot of native individuals who were nothing other than white and possibly Catholic or Protestant, like, generally speaking, not a lot of diversity. And in fact, you know, like, the area that I come from, sadly enough, around I come from a mix of French and English, so I don't really belong to the only English population. But the very strong English only population of where I come from is actually a study of inbreeding. Like, they're in Stansted, Quebec. This is where scientists go to study inbreeding because, of course, a small English population surrounded by French. Guess guess what's happening there? A lot of inbreeding. So I've got that to be proud of. So, you know, like, in a sense, you don't have to be too ashamed. It doesn't really matter where you come from. It doesn't affect your comprehension level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of great actors are from, like, Montana and Idaho. I mean, you would think they're all from California, but they're not.
Well, they went to California,
yeah.
Because that's where everybody who wanted to get noticed had to go, because it turns out that, you know, the globe is a really big place, and we tend to concentrate in some very small places, interestingly enough, called cities. And in these cities, some fairly amazing things tend to happen. I don't know if you're aware of these places called cities. Perhaps you've visited them.
Yeah, Des Moines.
You've never really visited a city then?
No, I
You have? You have? What cities have you been to?
We go to a lot of places on vacations, and like New York, and we've been to L.A.
Oh, well, at least that's good. I mean, you get to see the hustle and bustle. And you know, I hope that when you are an adult, you actually decide to stay in one of these places. I think every human being should. Like, I don't think every person should live there permanently. I don't think that's the idea. But you should go somewhere that's a city and see other human beings behaving there, because these are still amazing constructs that we've done. I'm not sure if anybody realizes how amazing a city is as a concept. It's not an easy thing to have.
Yeah. I think wherever you grow up, you want to live in the opposite after you leave. Like, you grew up in a small town, you want to live in a city. I don't want to live anywhere like Humboldt.
Well, okay. Let me finish the answer of the high school thing, because I don't want to diverge too far from that. But suffice to say, my high school had, you know, I would say it was reasonable, like, in terms, like, there were, you know, you wouldn't necessarily produce a lot of academic geniuses from this institution, but you wouldn't also produce any dummies. Like, I think it was a fair place where teachers do what teachers do. They try to work hard within the scope of what they have. But fortunately enough, I come from a province that's enlightened enough about certain subjects to, you know, so that 71% of the population in general in this province believe is in evolution. That's a badge of pride right there. That's like, wow, I come from there. This magical place that's 20 points above everyone else around. It's pretty fucking crazy. So it felt good. And
yeah, I haven't checked the stats on that in Iowa.
I wouldn't put it beyond like 30%, and that's probably being generous. And but, you know, here's the good news though. There'd probably be just as many, if not more, of the people who would say I don't.
Yeah, I hate that one.
No, but you know what? Like, here's the thing. At least that's an honest answer. And at least those people, you figure, well, all right, it's going to be an uphill battle. I got to teach you a thing or 10, but you know, maybe we can manage to come to an understanding where you realize that, yeah, it's probably true.
Yeah, I was watching the news, and I think it said something about gay marriages. Like, 12% of people were not sure about their stance on the topic. I'm like, how long have we been talking about this now? You should probably have an opinion by now.
Well, you'll notice that a lot of people, for them, having opinions can be a really dangerous thing. And you know what? Like, next, in the coming weeks, I've been talking about this a few shows. I have a guest that I want to have on the show. Her name is Deborah Feldman. She talks about growing up in a Hasidic Jew community. And you know what? Like, I could see if a person like her was still connected with that community, or at least with some religious group where they have so much invested that they've even chosen to supplicate their own opinions, then yeah, like, I can totally understand that, you know? Like, the I don't have an opinion folks are the ones that are probably caught between two worlds. And you know, like, or you talked about being in a class with 15 people against you. Lincoln, I got to tell you something. That's not something that a lot of people could do.
I'm honored.
You know, you should feel honored. Look, when I talk about shows, look, talk is cheap for me, okay? I mention shows where I recommend to people to try to come out and to be brave about it. And you know, like, I understand what the consequences of that are, but I don't have to deal with the realities, okay? I mean, just to give you an example, there's a young man who's in Pakistan who listens to the show all the time. He's just as bright as you, and you know, he's had the terrible foolish notion that he should let them know. And you know, like at that point, I become a little bit uncomfortable even with my own rhetoric, where I'm like, I have to consider the consequences of the things that I say and how they affect the quality of life of the people that I say it to, you know, and how I incense people to do things. That's just how I am, man. Like, you've probably heard in my voice, I don't know, I have like one of those crazy Jacob said it, so I'm just going to fucking do it things. You notice that? Yeah. Like, I'm fully aware of it. But don't you think that, like anybody else, I'm like aware of its maddening power? Like, I don't want to force people to live uncomfortable, horrible lives because I wanted to impose my vision of what the future is, uncaring of the fucking masses that had to deal with the consequences of my brave words and their brave actions. So, like, you know, I don't know where to stand about that. I feel like sometimes I got to be out there yelling to give you guys courage, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't know if I can deal with the consequences of the courage that I give you and its influence on your lives. Like, I think about that all the fucking time. It eats me up inside. It does. If it paid better, maybe I'd be less worried about it.
Let's jump to number 6 here. What math skills are required for this job? Very little, using fractions, simple algebraic functions, count money / change, measuring, using calculator / cash register.
You know what? Actually, a lot of math is actually involved. And I'll tell you why. Like, the degree of math that's involved is actually proportionate to the degree in which you can actually just understand what it is you're doing. Give you a good example. Like, part of the math that I do all the time is based on something called bounce rates. Okay? Now, when you have a website, one of the important things to note is how often people are actually visiting the things that you're producing. Because, you know, it's most of the people that visit a site will be there for a fraction of a second, and then they're gone. Now, they might have loved what you had to offer, but you're dealing with a person's, you know, like a fraction of a person's attention amongst a billion things that could be diverting it. Something on TV, a family member talking to them, boredom, being tired, half drunk, who knows? There's like I said, so many factors. And your bounce rate is an adequate representation of how much people are actually going into the content. Now, there's a lot, like, in, for instance, I'll give you a good example. When you study statistics in a few years, one of the things that you learn is you have to kind of ignore the outliers when you're looking at the data. And what that means is that you'll always have people that sort of, like, fluctuate. Like, a guy who's there for, you know, one day and he visits like 100 pages and that kind of stuff. And just like you have to ignore the dude who showed up for a fraction of a second, the page didn't load and he closed it. He didn't get to see anything. Because these people don't give you an adequate representation of the whole. All right? And this is an example of just basic way to look at your data that you have to crunch these numbers yourself. Right? Because although there are tools that allow you to do it, the data is still raw. You know, like a lot of people who do this, for instance, they'll look at days where they'll have an unusual amount of traffic. And because they don't really understand the idea that you can have these outliers, essentially days where you have a shitload of fucking traffic, the real result is in looking in the mean average of everything that you have. And now, here's the truth. Like, as much as I use it, I wish that I actually knew it better than I do know. It's kind of like on that list of things that I want to do as a beleaguered Renaissance man wannabe. And you know, it was the one thing that I used to have nightmares of till I was 23 years old. I used to have a nightmare where I had a math test and I wasn't really prepared for it. It was one of those things that fucking haunted me, because while I could understand the principles of math, the practicalities of it always escaped me, and it frustrated me. Mm-hmm. I felt stupid because of it.
Yeah, we're doing stuff with parabolas right now in math, and I'm like, I don't need this. What's the point of doing it?
But you know, but here's the thing. Like, remember what I was telling you about trying to get past that threshold, right? And a good example is, like, I keep thinking in everything that I do, some of the hardest stuff is doing the things you hate doing. Because, you know, like, one point you're like, what is the practical purpose of me going through and honestly tagging 2,000 posts that I should have been tagging from the get-go but didn't really think about it? And what is the point? And you realize that the benefits of it aren't things you can calculate now. You're like, you're right. At 15, what do you need to know about a parabola? But the truth is, you know, you're asking a question about a future unknown, right? And to say now that you know for certain what that person needs to know is the height of ignorance. It's so frighteningly ignorant that, you know, if I could go back in time and tell myself, like, what are the things that you regret doing? And I'm like, I regret balking at the pressures and the fears that I had when it came to math. I really do regret that because it was the one thing that made me feel stupid, and it was the one thing I retreated from. And you know what? That's the one thing I stopped doing when I became an adult, like running away from things that I was afraid of. And you know, it was one of those things where if I could go back, I feel like I'd have a bit of a better, you know, run at it, because it is part of something that, like, I realize now that so many of what I want to do is limited by my inability to actually put it down on fucking paper. I remember that the last years where I was in school, where I was in advanced math, and I just checked out because it seemed so daunting a task, and I was so busy just in my own world, like drawing and shit like that. That was all I could do then. It was all I was passionate about, and I thought that's what my future would be, you know? Like, and it's not. And when I go back, I realize that so much of that retreat was just the fear of having to deal with it. So, you know, like, what is the purpose of it? I mean, I got to tell you, like, you're going to have to talk to your future self about that. And if he's mad at it, you're going to have to fucking explain why you feared your ignorance so much to, you know, cause him despair in the future.
So what do I check? Measuring?
Measuring. Yeah, absolutely. What we call in the industry metrics. And yeah, exactly. So measuring your metrics, because it becomes an important way for you to realize what works and what doesn't work. Like, what do people respond to? When I was choosing what book I should write, that actually became like a really important part of it. I was like, what do people want and what did they respond to? And I have to just trust the numbers rather than trust some kind of intuitive, you know, it's, oh, I think I know better. No, the numbers will tell you. And everything else is just a lie. It's just your brain trying to trick you. Trust the numbers, not you.
Yeah. Geez, there are a lot of dumb questions on here. What tasks are performed as part of this job? List at least 10 duties.
Okay, well, one of the duties that I have to do is essentially I have to read. I would say that's probably the biggest thing on my list. Spend 5 hours minimum reading. For the most part, I used to read a lot of blog posts and things like that. Nowadays, I'm trying to read something a little bit different, but the point is, I mean, part of your job is to be informed about things that you think people should care about. So that's the first task, is to read. The second task is obviously I got to check my emails. I got to respond to customer problems. That's number two. Like, for instance, you email me and you're like, I paid for my bonus shows and it's not working. Which is like one of those, yes, I know there was a problem when you did the sign up. My system's not perfect. It often generates issues. So that's one of the unfortunate tasks on my list. And then you've got to check to make sure that, your accounts make sense, that, monies that you're transferring are going other places. Like, for instance, I have to, unfortunately, because so much of my user base is American, I have to kind of play the exchange rate a little bit. I got to wait until the American dollar is strong enough compared to the Canadian dollar to transfer monies to my account. So I have to kind of be aware and in a weird sense try to anticipate, because although they may seem like small amounts, like in the end of, you know, at the end of the day, it's like $30 or $40. But for me, that's the price of an extra membership. You know, like that's somebody who came over to the site and signed anew, which is still a big deal for me at this point, lost because I wasn't really paying attention to when the dollar was strong or weak. So there's that factor. The other thing too is that I've got to write posts. So what that means is research in terms of issues that you think people should be aware of, and later on, like writing your own opinion about it, because it's not just. I mean, I'm not link farming anything. There's a lot of sites that do that, and you know they decide they're going to be amalgams of other people's content. And I have a kind of a general policy, which is if you're going to use content, then you must produce content yourself. Like that no one could ever sort of like if a person came over to me and said, hey, you used my photo in your article, that I could always say, well, listen, I'm glad it put it down, but I was using it to promote your work or to talk about things that you were doing. And really what my job was like at that point, my understanding was I thought you would rather people be aware than not aware. But if you want me to take it down, I take it down. And this is kind of like you have to understand that the internet market as it stands is not just a simple thing where I just post stuff on a site and that's all there is. There's a large part of it is you're negotiating with a larger community of content producers and, you know, content abusers. So you got to make sure that you're not a content abuser, because that negatively affects your reputation, which ultimately affects the way that other sites represent you, how you get linked in other places. Like, this is the serious work that all sites who want to fucking make money have to do, right? You have to worry about your reputation. You have to worry about how others perceive you. And you have to worry about their ability to send you links, which are the currency of the internet. Like, a link from, say, Wikipedia, not in necessarily dollar senses, because it's hard to describe now what that dollar sense means, but in real senses, it has a lot of value, a huge amount of value, because of the way that the internet works. So trying to make it big to a large degree is maintaining a reputation, developing relationships with other people in the business that do what you do, and gaining their respect, because if you don't have that, then like you're fucked. Like you'll be blackballed, you'll never get links, and it's the end of you. So, you know, these are important things you have to maintain those, and part of what you have to do is trackbacks, links backs. You got to give love back to people, especially if they're giving love back to you. You know, like this is a reciprocal relationship. The internet is built on, you know, this kind of establishment of trust, and like it has to be a situation where their labor and your labor equals something more, where you're adding more than the sum of its parts. I don't know if that's. Does that make any sense? I feel like it's business jargon.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay.
How much interaction does a worker have with coworkers?
Okay, well, in my case, what I don't have is necessarily co-workers so much as I have partners. Like, for instance, Ryan is a partner in a lot of what I do. So even though, you know, on the show we do talk quite a bit, in real life we don't interact that much. Like, he has quite a bit of stuff that he's doing that's very independent. He works on FightLinker. He works on other stuff. And, you know, we have our own lives. So we don't really interact that much. On the other side, there are people that help me with what I do. Some people who, you know, for instance, try to find me interesting links that I can talk about or put on my Twitter. Because this is, you know, like part of what I do is there's not just the blog that you have to maintain. It's that the internet is divided amongst a multitude of areas that you have to cover. You have to cover your Twitter. You have to make sure that people who follow you have interesting news and link backs to your site. This is all just sort of like the regular fucking day-to-day thing that every person has to do who wants to make this into a business. You have to make sure that you write a certain amount of articles. You have to make sure that you share stuff from Facebook, which is its own internet. Like 10% of all my traffic comes from Facebook. All right, that's like its own world. And the more I tap into that, the more I get back from it. But that only adds to sort of like, you know, the giant list of things that you have to fucking do in a day. I could spend all day on Facebook, but, you know, what about all these other things that kind of get to the wayside? So it's very much like juggling, you know, 10 different jobs at once.
What advice would you give a person interested in this career?
Well, there's a lot of advice that I give. Like every once in a while, there's somebody who comes to me and they're like, I want to do this for a living. I want to just do what you do. Now, I normally have kind of like a test that I put people through to, you know, to see how much they're willing to work at it. Because like I said before, the biggest, most important factor of this is determination. It is so primary and difficult to explain that I'm like, you need to have a will of iron to continue to do something that at most times seems like a total waste of your efforts. Like, it's hard to describe exactly. Like, you could be big on the internet and people still don't really give a shit in the real world. Like, as far as people are concerned, you are an ethereal entity that doesn't exist. And because of that relationship, it's not the same as if I open up a fucking mom and pop shop next door. You would pass by mom and pops every fucking day reminding you that you're not there providing patronage. But on the internet, you can be as ignored as anything else because you were a mysterious discovery amongst a million other people that were trying to cram their way into your lives. So why should anyone give a shit? And the truth of the matter is that you find yourself often in the situation where if you don't constantly work at giving people a reason to give a shit, then they won't. And it doesn't matter what your fucking story is. You could be the greatest dude in the world. And because you are not present in their lives, they can ignore you. And that is the most frightening thing. Like, my advice is that you can't stop. Like, every day where you don't do it is a lost fucking day. And that's the worst feeling, too, at the same time. Because, you know, so much of what you do on the internet is actually, it really gets ignored for the most part until a few people catch on. And if those people actually catch on, like, your whole future changes drastically. Like, this happened to those... remember the auto-tune news guys? No, anyways, they went from just doing weird remixes of the news and being ignored to having like a super huge giant fucking explosion of attention when they hit the right note. And that really changed the whole game for them. And in a sense, that is what everybody who works like a fucking maniac on the internet is secretly hoping for. Even though that is probably for most people the most terrifying reality out there. Like, I don't know, most people could actually deal with the aftermath of like success. Like, I don't know how I deal. Like, what I have right now is, I would say, I have what is the result of a lot of just hard work combined with luck. And, you know, the fact that people eventually just find me, they find something they like about what I said, and they stick around. And I've done this long enough that this core of individuals has allowed me to continue to do what I'm doing. It's large enough of a fucking group. And I've figured out a way through, like, a completely new business ideal, which is called freemium. You know, it's a very recent invention in the world of the internet. But if you think about it, it's actually a much older idea. It's kind of the old idea of patronage. You know, back in like Renaissance Italy, for instance, where they viewed art pretty much as a business, you know, you would invest a certain amount in artists that would produce works and things like that. And it's not unlike what I'm doing now. I do this just a few 100 times or hopefully thousands of times and try to find success that way. I mean, one of your questions, what was that last question? How much, like, we'll skip to that one right now. How much do I make or a year is one of the questions.
What is the beginning pay for this job?
Well, okay. Here's the thing, too, that you have to kind of understand. I'm going to tell you a number, and it's going to be really low. But the truth is that if you were to ask a person how much they actually make when they start a business, the numbers that I give you will always be inflated. So when I tell you that, for instance, on any given month, the average that I make is probably $500 to $600 a month, all right, that for most people is a disturbingly low amount. Now, it's not a lot of money, that is for sure. But the truth is that in most businesses, while they can make money, how much of that money is actually profit? Right? A very small percentage of it turns out, in a lot of businesses. And plenty of businesses make money but never turn a profit. And they go under, even though they seem to have been successful. They're like, well, they never had enough residuals to pay anyone. And that was a big problem. And this is the major advantage of the job that I do. Because this is, again, it's kind of a numbers game. It's where, yeah, like I make this amount at the numbers that I have. And my numbers aren't really that fantastic. Like I have probably around, I estimate about 4,000, a little bit over 4,000 people who regularly listen to the show. And then the rest are kind of, you know, vagabonds that occasionally listen, come in and out, because you always lose people, right? They move in and out. But they're like the cloud of people who just sort of like generally pay attention. And they could be, you know, they could be double that number. I have plenty of shows that have reached double that number in terms of just listens. But I know how many people will really listen. If I put out a show immediately and I need everyone to just pay attention, that is the number that I generally associate with. And that's another important thing, by the way, that I need to mention is that when you're doing this business, always estimate down. Lower your numbers. Don't overassume your size, because the truth is so many of those visits may be bots, you know, maybe just a person who's really looking for something else. They're not true reflections. What really matters is actually the people that give a shit. You know, the ones that if you just said, hey, guys, I want to quit, pay up and fucking say, you know, pay attention and say, I don't want you to quit. What is that number? You know, like how many people really care? And that's actually the number of people that really matter. And everything else that anyone's ever told you in terms of building traffic is a liar. Like, sure, you know, if you have an inflated site, you think you're getting a lot of traffic numbers, you figure, hey, I'm going to be a fucking success. But there's plenty of sites that get bad fucking numbers, or that get great numbers, that are just sucky. They don't make any money. They're the same thing that I was telling you before. They're so busy spending money in advertising to get the click-throughs, they don't make any money from those click-throughs. So achieving a balance is like, how do you find a way to do something that you can get dividends for, that doesn't cost a lot of money, but that still has value? And the truth is that's really hard to produce. It's kind of like a musician, right? Like he has to produce music. Really, it's just notes recorded. Why shouldn't it be fucking copied endlessly and he be just totally ripped out of that, the ability to make money? In this new world, that's possible. And the only reason where we, you know, if I tell you that and you know, your first instinct is to say, no, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound right at all. You should be able to make something from it. I think that we live in a world where that's actually possible now. Where yes, whatever works you produce can be replicated endlessly. But if that's true too, that means that an endless amount of people have listened to what you've done. And that should matter. And your job is to actually try to get it to matter. So it's not just like when you pay to become a member, you're not really paying for shows on my thing. You're paying for me to keep producing shows, for me to keep doing this fucking thing. Because a lot of times I'll give out shows for free. I don't know if it frustrates people who are paying members that I give a lot of shows for free. I hope it doesn't. I hope they realize that, look, the only reason I'm doing this is because the only way to make sure that a person gives you something is to give them so much that they get sickened by how much they haven't given you back.
Yeah. you pay $5 and you don't get $10 back.
You know, it's weird because there is something to be said about the responsibility that people feel after a certain amount of things that you've given them. You just have to be clear, though, that whatever it is that you're giving them has value and that they should appreciate that. And the rest is up to them. So if you can set up a system for yourself, I mean, I don't care what it is. Talking about atheism is just what I chose. It could be talking about anything else, you know, like that a person is interested in, or it could just even be music that you're producing. You could use the same system that I've designed, which is to say, give out as much as you fucking can, but at the same time, just enough where they realize that they should probably give back. And then that's all you need, because at that point, I think that people sort of like realize the real value of what it is you produce, and they want to be a part of it. And that's where I hope that anybody who does this gets to transcend it. Because, you know, I may do it and fail, maybe yet be a thing, because like this is tough. Atheism is a tough market. Okay, I don't know if it's a real market, but it's a tough market. People don't give a lot of money, even though everyone pretends they're generous. It's not really that, you know, that much. It's not really that generous when you compare it to a lot of the other religious organizations, what they get from their poor. But, you know, we have pragmatic group members, and they live in the Great Depression, and they don't want to give you money easily. And, like, what the fuck am I going to tell them? No, stop. Without me, you're going to go to hell. I don't have any leverage. No leverage and no money, okay? Have you heard of indulgences? Do you know what this is? No? Okay, I'll give you another history lesson. See, after the invention of the printing press, one of the things that the church really started making a lot of money with was these indulgences. Essentially what they were was these printed documents where the church was saying, if you pay a certain amount of money, you will be forgiven any sin. They paid for the Vatican with this thing. Just to give you an idea of how much money you could just make when you create this artificial demand. It's amazing, isn't it? So, you know, one of the negative consequences of the printing press. Oh, well. Oh, well. The rest of it was still all good. All right, let's move on. What's your next question?
How many hours per week do you work?
That is a good question. Because it's really hard to fucking determine. I was thinking about this the other day because at first I thought, well, maybe I should calculate how many hours I just spend on the site or how many hours I spend doing, you know, like the normal banking stuff that you have to deal with. Just the regular things of business, right? You got your business stuff. You have your creative stuff that you have to produce. So times where, like, say I was calculating how many hours does it take me to prepare for a show? How many hours does it take me to edit the show, to then do the graphics to do the show, to put it up, to then test it, and all this other kind of stuff. It's just like the list of 1,000 things that you have to do. Okay. So there's that part, but then there's the other part that doesn't seem as obvious. Like, for instance, well, I don't know how most people browse the internet, but if you saw, like, I have Google Chrome, and on Google Chrome you have a list of the 10 most visited sites, or I think it's 10. And I have the most boring list of 10 sites that you've ever seen in your life. Like, I'm actually kind of perturbed. Like, I don't think I use the internet. Because for the most part, it's either business stuff, my own site stuff, which is, you know, you have to visit it because people comment and shit like that. And I always like to stay ahead, you know, as soon as there's a person who's writing stuff, you kind of have to know. Like, sometimes they actually give you good stuff, like a link to a really awesome article, and, you know, whatever. So there's that. There's the one entertainment site that I go to is like a gaming site. That is like the one interesting thing that is on what is otherwise like the most dull working fucking site. Because my entire day is spent trying to find cool videos, articles that I should be aware of. I read science magazines like there's nobody's business. For me, you know, like if I'm not working on the internet by looking through, because I mean, every day I go through Facebook and I look at people's feeds that I subscribe to, because there's a lot of people that put up some quality stuff that I love to share. You know, like I think that's what I'm good at, sharing stuff that other people are really like, you know, finding the gems. That's what I think I try to do. But if I was to tell you how many hours every day that I'm spent either working on the site, working on a project for the site and stuff like that, I would be sad to tell you that there wouldn't be a lot of free time. Like, it is my life. Like, the brief periods where there is any respite is where I am just checked the fuck out playing some video game, like a million fucking miles away, where, like, this is the last thing I'm thinking about. You know, where you're just like, okay, if anybody's messaging me, I'm gone. Like, I don't want to think about anything. Like, I'm going to be in Skyrim, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah. Well, it's like good TV, you know? You need to have good research for a show like The Wire to happen.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, and you know, like, I guess it's difficult for me to explain how much work that is, because, like I said, I mean, everybody takes it for granted, but we're at we've done over 265 episodes by now. And I'm like, I'm not that knowledgeable. Look, I ran out of shit that was popping into my head, I think episode like 40, which is when it actually started getting good. Like, when I actually had to start researching is when I had to put myself in a position where, you know, I had to admit things that I didn't know. It's a fucking embarrassing position, but it was the best thing that could ever fucking happen to me, running out of the things I already had an opinion about and needing to formulate my own. And for the most part, you know, like, it's people who listen that have kept me on my fucking toes. When I was in Washington, Ashley was telling me she's been listening since episode 20. Episode 20. I don't even remember that episode. I don't even remember where I lived when I recorded that episode. I mean, doing it since 2007, and some people have been listening to it that long. You know, you don't actually realize that when you put yourself out there and you're like, yep, I'm going to decide to be a kind of web personality, you're married to that shit now. You're like, that's it. You decided that you were going to do that, so do it. And you know, like, very recently, just when you started listening was when I was pretty sure I was going to quit. It was, yeah. I mean, and the truth was just because, you know, like, the persistence thing that I was telling you about, like, you just get to the point where you're like, I'm not sure I can keep doing this. But, you know, truth of the matter is, how many people have really asked themselves that question? How many times are you going to ask yourself that question if you're going to do anything successful? Well, like I said before, I mean, so much of what you learn is built on a mountain of failure that I can't stress how important it is. It's the most embarrassing, humiliating, horrible fucking trudge you'll ever go through, this failure shit. But when you're done, you know, like, you'll be like fucking Goku, man. You'll be like a Super Saiyan, you know what I mean? Like, you were training in 100 times gravity. You're a god by the time it's done. It's just the slog there, man. Sometimes you feel like it never really ends, but you do get to a point. This is the good news. You do get to a point where you could actually see yourself getting smarter and it's all good. Just when you know how ignorant you are, can you be like, all right, I can start getting smart again, or at least feeling that way again. And remember this too. This is a really important thing, that people who are very stupid overestimate how intelligent they are, and people who are intelligent underestimate how intelligent they are. And all that tells you is that when you're stupid and, you know, if like you feel brilliant, the truth is you're probably stupid. And if you're feeling stupid, you might be brilliant.
Yeah. I'm trying to do this, like, TV show thing. You know, I've got it all planned out and all that.
Is that right?
But, yeah. I mean, it's a whole TV show over here, but I'm stuck at this one part, and I'm always stuck at one part, and I hate that. And that's just the writing process. You have to get stuck, and you have to work your way through it. Otherwise, it's going to be no good.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, the funny thing about it is when people think, you know, I have to work through it, and you know, you may hate the slog. And there are many times I do hate the slog. But the truth is, you catch yourself later on reading or you know, something that you've written in the past where you thought there's nothing I can produce that's good, and you realize that's not half bad. You were just being overly critical of yourself and not realizing, look, there's a genuine idea there. That's all that you needed. The rest is kind of how you gussy it up. And if you're, and if you feel really, you know, if you feel a lack of confidence from what you're writing, a lot of it probably has to do with how you feel it's gussied, right? Where you're like, I'm not saying it right or blah, blah. And this is a lot of it. A lot of it is just worried, like a kind of internalized fear of how will others perceive this? Am I going to be viewed as stupid? And you know what? Like every fucking day you go through this. I don't care who you are. You always have this fear of someone saying, like, is someone going to tear through something I said? Is it over? Am I a fucking idiot? But, I mean, like, look, if it wasn't for the self-doubt, you'd be that fucking idiot that thought he was brilliant. Right? Like, the self-doubt is really the one thing that you can always count on to keep you honest and to make sure that you're improving yourself. And as long as you have that fucking goal in mind, I mean, like, yeah, there are days where you're going to feel like total crap about what you produced. But, I mean, try to speak to yourself in 20 years. What are you going to, you know, like, what are you going to say to him? Are you going to try to apologize because you wrote something you weren't 100% on? No, I mean, like, that guy 20 years from now is going to be begging to read the stuff that you were writing, wondering, like, because, you know, I'm going to tell you that the one thing that your future self is going to want is to understand your past self and to see if there's any part of, you know, that can connect. And you know, your writing now, to a large degree, is going to do that. You may forget a lot about the things that you felt were important, and which is what I would say, like, I feel now, you know, as an adult. I forgot about all those things that I thought were important as a fucking teenager. They're gone, dude. They weren't. I wish I could understand if they even register as important, or maybe I'm biased. I don't know because I'm older. But the you know, like, in a sense, I wish I would have produced more work back then than I would have kept, because I wish I could have seen my own progression, even though at the time I thought I felt embarrassed by my own limitations. I didn't see that that looking at the road there was so much more important to me, you know, as my older self. Like, I needed to see that. So, I mean, I hope that you keep that in mind when you write.
And with this show, I mean, I know I have this limit in my mind. You know, I'm 15 years old, I'm not going to have a TV show. But that's not entirely unrealistic, is it?
Well, you know what I always say to people that they should do? I mean, establish your treasure trove of ideas when you're young. You know, like, I have a project list of just phase one ideas. There are things that I've always dreamed of doing. Like, you know, some people know this, that I wanted to make my own version of Shining Force, which was an old game when I was a kid, set to Alexander the Great. I mean, like, that's on my treasure list. You know, like, if I had some fucking money, I'd do that. And truth be told, you know, like, I may never sort of, like, reach that point. I'm obviously not going to work with that in mind. But if I did, imagine my fucking delight if I had recorded these ideas from the fucking get-go. I'm like, I'm set. Each one of these ideas, even though, you know, maybe in the future you're like, I want to tweet that shit. I mean, the beginning of an idea is better than none. And there is a limit to when you can actually produce creative materials. I don't know when that limit is, but every fucking genius in the history of geniuses has said that there was a time where they could produce no more works.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
I have like 50 folders on the desktop. There's like an idea for a book or something like that. No words to it, you know, just like five-word sentences or something.
Well, you know what? You probably find yourself a lot like me. It's one of those, I have like 10 ideas a minute. And the thing, the really difficult part for us is always making sure that we marry ourselves to the one idea where we're like, no, we got to do that one, right? There's a ton of others on that, like, back burner. And every once in a while when you get really fucking, I don't know, I don't want to say depressed because that's the wrong word. When you get really just annoyed at what you're doing, those other ideas seem really attractive. You know, sometimes you even want to just fucking abandon everything you do because you're just like, I want to feel good again. I want to feel like what I'm doing has hope and shit like that, because whatever it is I am seems hopeless, like it's going nowhere. But, I mean, again, like, think about it from the perspective that who's going to be the best at sabotaging your own efforts? Like, your doubts? Like, It's what they're there for. You know, like the creeping doubt that you have was the instinct that prevented your ancestor from jumping over a cliff when he was curious about it. It's really powerful and fucking advantageous instinct to have. Unless you're trying to lead an extraordinary life, then you got to be fucking brave, dude. I mean, if you want a TV show, you're going to have to be brave. You're going to have to face a lot of criticisms, a lot of fucking no's. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I actually did a TV show pilot. Like, we were trying to shop it around. It wasn't for Good Atheist. It was for our other stuff with Fightlinker. You would watch the show. I do have a vision for the Good Atheist show, although I don't know if anybody would like it. It's essentially today's version of Johnny Carson, but me as Johnny Carson. I don't like Ricky Gervais' show. I want to be nostalgia 50s. That's what I want. I like those old school things. I mean, I want to invite guests that I think that people should be aware of. I want to talk about issues that I think are relevant. For me, a talk show would be fucking perfect. Except for there are no limits on what people can say. Any topic is open, and it's not going to be one of those, oh, the broadcasters or like the advertiser decided you can't say that. Well, fuck you. We are user supported.
Yeah, like Bill Maher. That's why I like him so much. Commercials. He can go as long as he wants. He can say whatever he wants.
That's true. There you go. I want to be the new Bill Maher, I guess. He will die eventually, and then I'll take his mantle. Let's move on. Next question.
What are the major advantages and disadvantages of this occupation?
Major advantage is that I can live anywhere I want to live. And while that might not seem like a big deal, if you think about it, that could be pretty sweet. Like, I lived a few months in Dominican Republic, although admittedly I didn't do a very good job at maintaining my show loads and things like that. My fault. It was my first time, and I was in love, and I was, you know, there with my soon-to-be wife. So, I mean, perhaps I could be forgiven for not being the best at that time, but the major advantage is that I'm not tied to any place. And in a world where, you know, you can live cheaply in some of these more tropical areas, it is really advantageous. I would say that's probably the sexiest thing about this job is that you can live anywhere. Now, if you want to talk about major disadvantages, well, I mean, the first major disadvantage is to your time. Like, you're beholden to the internet. You can't be anywhere where the internet is not. You have to be connected with it all the time. I mean, like, it's not just from the perspective of needing to know news. It's just that, you know, I have thousands of members, people who have problems and issues that I have to deal with. I am my only customer support. And I have, like, more members than most small parties. So, yeah, like, there is a certain element of customer fucking service that's there as a one-man goddamn operation. And, you know, my whole thing is I really don't like people waiting on stuff. Like, if there's anyone out there, by the way, that I've not, like, if they paid for stuff and they didn't get it, like, you need to let me know. Like, as organized as I try to be, the truth is that there is a lot of members. Like, I'm in a situation where I wish I could have an employee, like somebody who took care of, you know, the admin aspect, so I could really focus on doing the rest of the stuff, which is working on shows, working on the book, working on articles. But, you know, like, I'm not there yet, so I have to spend that many more hours doing everyone's job. Like, If anyone thinks that the Good Atheist is a kind of operation that can be a one-man thing, I got to tell you, already I have co-hosts, so the answer is no.
I would do the technical support if I knew how to do it.
Well, I appreciate that, but you know what, like, the truth is, if you ever try to do this, one of the most important lessons that you learn is that a lot of people are always willing to, you know, give you their time, but they're not always willing to commit to that time. And, you know, the same way that a person is willing to commit to their own projects. I mean, people have lives, right? I mean, you're 15, so time may seem disposable to you. But, I mean, I get lots of offers from well-meaning individuals who are like, I want to help you. And a lot of times I have to kind of say thanks, but no thanks, just because it would be more time managing them to ultimately fail than it would be, you know, sort of time-saving. And it's just because you cannot survive on the good intentions of people. That's a lesson I would tell you. This industry? No, but I mean in general, like even if you're doing something that people are passionate about and they would really have something invested, is you can't count on that because they have their own lives to worry about. You know, like even as much as they are invested potentially emotionally in what it is you do, they're so much more emotionally involved in everything else that they're doing, their own lives, that you can't rely on your life being dictated by that. So that's a really tough thing. I mean, like, eventually you can reach a size where that changes, where you go from being, say, a one-man operation to actually being a legitimate business. And truth is, if I had, like, advertising, like most other types of sites with similar sizes, I'd probably be doing quite well. But there's, you know, this is activism. So there's not really, you know, what I'm doing is activism based, but it's like the business of it doesn't have to be activism, right? It could be anything. You could have a fucking podcast on Fudgios. Like, honestly, if people love Fudgios enough and you were good enough at doing it, you could do what I do and do Fudgios and have fucking advertising monies up the wazoo. Just, you need to find 250 or 260 episodes to keep people excited about Fudgios, that's all.
I think podcasting is the opposite of TV. You know, TV goes on for too long and people stop watching, but the longer podcasts like this go on for, the more people want to listen to this.
Well, there is a weird, I mean, I'm never quite sure how long the podcast should be. Every once in a while, somebody will come up to me and be like, can you make it as long as possible? At the Reason Rally, I had someone come up and said, I'm training for marathons, so please make sure the podcast is super long. And I'm fully aware that people are, you know, going through the regular rigmarole of having to travel for hours or having to, you know, another popular thing that people do when they listen to the show is they work out, which is just time of their day to make sure that their bodies don't crumble. And in the meantime, they want some company in this utmost boredom as they fight the forces of gravity to try to remain healthy. I'm like, all right, fight one of those fundamental forces if you want. I'll try to entertain you as long as possible. But, I mean, you're right. It is a bit of the opposite because, in a way, when you watch something, you're relying on something very different. You know, we're a very visual species now. We don't tend to listen as much, which is perhaps why I would say that if you want to make a living doing what I'm doing, you should probably do video rather than audio. But there is a certain quality to audio, which I find myself much more adept at. Like, I'm a much better talker. I could probably talk for 3 hours and make it somewhat palpable. But the point is, you know, like, that medium itself is, you know, even though people like listening to long podcasts, I got to tell you, most of the time, they're totally tuned out, man. They're half listening to you.
Yeah.
So.
But I listen to it at 11:30 when I'm going to sleep. It takes about two nights.
Let me get this straight. So you're the last voice that you hear before you go to bed. See, that worries me now. Oh boy. Okay, what's your next question?
Okay. How was your performance evaluated, and how often?
Well, in this is actually kind of the funny thing about what I do is, in a sense, no one is evaluating your performance, but everybody is, right? Like, let's say I put out a show and it was really bad. I'm trying to think when was the last time I put out a really bad show. It was probably a couple times. But anyways, you know, I just released one. It's totally, I mean, everything I say on it is untrue. I sound like a complete fucking idiot the whole time. And it's just, I don't know. I'm having an off day and I put it out there. There will be thousands of people that will know and forever know that I had a bad day. And, you know, that I'm fully aware that every time I do a show, there is a big difference. Like, if I release a really good show, I'll sell a bunch of memberships. No fucking problem. But if I release an okay show, just an okay one, not so much. So in a sense, there's a real pressure to be like, I gotta make sure this is a good show. Otherwise, we're broke. So you do feel that pressure, and you know, part my whole thing is that I don't want to, I don't want to let anybody down that listens to the show. Like I want them to just every show to be as good as the last one, and that's kind of difficult when you're always trying to sort of like push to make sure that everyone's like, you know, totally addicted to it. So while I have no one that comes down and they're like, that was a bad job, at the same time, I don't have anybody that comes up to me and says, that was a good job. I mean, fans do send emails. I don't want to just, you know, say that their input isn't important. Of course it is. But, you know, at the same time, like, you know, how these people have been listening to the show for a long time. Are they going to really be honest with you? Maybe they just love everything you do, even when it's crap. And you're not even sure if that praise is genuine. Like, how do I measure how do I know that I did a good job? How do I know unless it was like, it's like one of those weeks where, at least for me, I guess, the turnaround is the only way that I get to measure. But that's not a really good fucking measure, right? It could be a tough month, right? Maybe February, March, maybe these are horrible months where nobody fucking spends any money. And maybe then I was doing amazing for the month of March. But because there's no way for me to know, I have no idea. Maybe lots of people are actually sending me the equivalent of like 10 Christmas bonuses if times were good. But I'm so focused on, you know, sort of like my own situation that I don't see it. So this is a big problem with what I do.
Yeah, you're talking about how everyone else is, you know, you have to lower your estimates for how many you're watching and listening. But this is a situation where you have to evaluate yourself. You know, how good did I do on the podcast?
Oh, yeah, on a constant basis. I mean, and imagine, like, every time I do a show, I got to go and listen back to it and try to edit it. And sometimes you're like, oh, man, I wish I hadn't said that. But I got to keep it in there because it makes the flow of the show go better. So you can't always get rid of what you say. So you do have to face, like, everyone is their own worst critic. So if you have to face yourself every day, that is a really tough thing because, trust me, you don't want you as your own boss. You might think you want because you're like, hey, this boss gives me a lot of freedom, but he's also really hard on you, and he's not quick with the praise. I mean, the only reason why people tend to, you know, like what the difference between people who can make and who don't make it, there tends to be one sad truth about them. They tend to be slight egomaniacs, and you know why? Because they're their only fans for a long time. And you need to have at least one fan. Sometimes that's going to be you. All right, next question.
What fringe benefits are available to the employees of this big business that you run? Sick leave, insurance, vacation?
No to all these things. But anyone who works for me gets the free books that I get. I mean, that's one of the perks that I get now that I've gotten a little bit bigger. I get advanced copies of books or free books, so I get to interview the authors, which is something I'm going to be doing a lot more in the coming months. And that for me is, I mean, I can't even tell you how much that saves me in terms of money. Like, I used to spend a lot of money on books, but now that I can get the books that I want and I get to interview the people that I have read the books, I don't know, it feels really special. Like, it feels like for me when I'm reading a person's book, And I get to interview them, I feel like I'm just, I feel in a privileged place. Like, other people should be as lucky as me. It's like, hey, did you get to read this book and talk to the person who wrote it? Because I did, and that was cool.
Yeah. Speaking of books, because you know how I've written them, how do you get them published?
Well, the truth is, if you want to get published, the first thing, if you want to go through the traditional avenue of publishing, you're going to have to find yourself an agent. No one takes unsolicited materials without an agent. And the problem is really finding agents. You know, like trying to are you going to be one of those diamonds in the rough that gets discovered? The truth is, though, I mean, you're kind of living in a time where self-publishing is a little bit more of an option. Like, that's what I'm going to go for. Like, even though I have connections with people that send me free manuscripts and things like that, I can't submit my manuscript to them. despite the fact that I have thousands of people that I've marketed towards, I still have a hard time getting through to them. But if you think about it, I've already done that work, right? I have a market. It's my market. It's the people that give a shit about what I do. And I can sell them a book, and that's what I'm going to, you know, like my original plan to say I'm going to work my ass off to essentially get a fan base and then sell them a book. I would say that if you can't get through the normal avenues of publishing in the future, this is the avenue to go through. I don't know what that, how that translates to a person who's like an author who's writing, say, stories or something like that. I do know, although I don't necessarily recommend that, is that there are some sites that use a kind of similar model to mine in terms of freemium, where they publish stories, and some of them are things that people have to pay more for, so on and so forth. But that, you know, like for that to happen, you would need to establish a fan base of people that enjoyed your writing. And you know what? That's a lot of work. So you've got a couple options. I mean, one, you could work your ass off to get an agent. Two, you could try to work your ass off and try to get a fan base and do it by yourself, which means you get more profitability, but all the risk. So I think at that point, you know, like you kind of have to ask yourself which direction sounds like a better plan. And I mean, you're still very young, so the truth is there could be lots of different ways for you to go about it. You could find that there's programs for young authors that help publish them. Like I remember there was this government program, at least this is in Canada, but they may have something similar in your country. Well, maybe for the next couple of weeks. But anyways, they used to have these grants where if you had a certain amount of words published, you could get a grant to write a book. But, you know, they had to be sort of like standard publications and things like that. So, I mean, a lot of people who just try to get work or try to get books published, they will start that way. They'll write articles. They'll try to meet the right people and find someone who is eventually going to like their writing enough to hook them with the right folks. And, you know, like at that point, that's something else I would recommend. I mean, if your writing is good, there's always going to be places that need it. And you can start establishing a fan base if your stuff's good. And I mean, like, the sooner you do it, even if it's just a kind of one of those things of being like, all right, you know, you promise yourself once every 2 weeks, you're going to write something and you're going to make sure that people subscribe to it and just follow what you're writing. But you've got to be like, one, if you're going to do it, you've got to be consistent about it. And you've got to sort of like respect the people that follow your shit. And, you know, like you can't abandon them fucking willy nilly. You got, you know, like if you're not producing something, you got to talk to these people. Like these are human fucking beings. You can't just like take them for granted, right? So, you know, that would be my final bit of advice if you're going for the more I'm trying to establish a reputation for myself online rather than the publishing industry, which is honestly shrinking. It's honestly shrinking. So what's it going to be like by the time you're 22, 23, like young, hungry, and probably at the point where people are starting to fucking pay attention to your shit because you're an adult now? Like you'll need a couple factors of credibility, and I'm not lying when I say age is one of them. But you know what? Like just take this time to realize that if you're fucking already writing shit that you're, you know, somewhat proud of now, what is it going to be like in 10 years? You're going to fucking bury everybody, but you got to stick with it, and you can't just suddenly start assuming that you're due anything. Like, no one owes you fucking shit. So, you know, like anything that you're going to bake, like I said before, I mean, if you found a voice in something good, I don't think that it would be impossible for you to find people that are interested in your shit long enough for you to like get those factors.
I think American society gets you ready for that. No one will do anything. You have to do all this stuff on your own.
There's not a lot of it's weird because, you know, your country has the highest proportion of people giving to charity, but also the lowest public opinion when it comes to charitable like programs. Like there's a really strong sense that you got to lift yourself up by the bootstraps, and it's not something that's felt by the rest of the world, who just, you know, says life is tough and why do we need to make it tougher on people. Anyways, next question.
Alright, I'm not supposed to ask you these, but I can't really determine. Describe the atmosphere of the job site in terms of eye appeal, comfort, and climate. I don't know, how does Audacity look? White.
Well, you know what? Work environment isn't just the place where you record stuff. It's also, I mean, imagine if you work from home, work environment is actually pretty important. Like, can you work from anywhere? Like, not everybody can. Some people, they have to go to, like, a place that's a bit more structured. You get a lot of folks who go to, like, coffee shops, shit like that. And some people actually get offices just to feel more like they're working. And that's just because, like, you can only work from bed for so long before you start feeling like this ain't real. So work environment actually can be important. And you know what? Like, the truth is, you know, as petty as that sounds, no one can work in a mess. I don't care what anyone tells you when they're like, oh, I work better in a mess. You know what? Everyone, if you work still well in a mess, you'll work even better when it's fucking clean.
Yeah. I hate having my room washing and dirty. It's just
Well, you know what? It's. I think the difference is that once, I mean, like, I'm the kind of person that's like, I'll put up with disorder for like a day or two if I'm feeling like I don't really give a shit. But then after that, you know, like, you have to, because there's something called the broken window syndrome, which is when you see things around you that are decrepit and busted, you don't care about things around you as much. And that actually affects your mentality. If you don't care about the environment around you enough to keep it clean, then, you know, what is that going to do to your psychology? So it shouldn't be underestimated. I mean, we can wallow in our messes because we can mostly ignore them. But don't think that the rest of you, your unconscious, ignores the reality of the mess around you. So just be aware that, you know, if you're miserable and you look around you and your fucking place is a goddamn mess, then maybe that contributes to it. Just a fucking thought. I would say that, generally speaking, try to keep the atmosphere, like, positive, and, like, I want to make sure that everybody's still having, like, fun. Because, you know, me and Carissa, when we're together, we often work in the same room, like we work from home. So we try to make sure that, you know, the place is clean and we're feeling good and productive on paper.
Describe the attitude of the employees and customers you've encountered.
Well, I'll focus mostly on the quote-unquote customers. So far, I mean, the funny thing is everyone who's ever hung out with me has been simultaneously surprised and I don't want to say let down, but I suppose maybe people expect something different from what I offer from the show. Like, so if I'm talking to them, they may feel as though I'm trying to be on, or I'm just like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm going through an act, and I suppose that to some degree it can make people kind of feel uncomfortable at first. But I try to identify that, yes, although on the show I am slightly more animated than I may be in person, or maybe a little bit more eloquent, at least I try to be. The truth is, this is me on a fucking constant basis. And when people do meet me, I guess that's the part that's sort of like simultaneously gratifying and hilarious at the same time. Like, they just can't get over this fact that I'm like, oh, so you're just you, right? Like, you weren't anybody else. To which you answer, who else do you expect me to be? I can be only me. Only me. Exactly. Wow, it was so eloquent, except for, you know, he'd probably write it better. But, yeah, like, I guess, I mean, I've had a ridiculously positive experience, despite the fact that I complained last show that when I went to the Reason Rally, I was disappointed because so few people showed up. You know, the truth is there was lots of other people that probably wanted to and that couldn't. I was just hoping that wasn't going to be an issue at the time. And I guess, you know, it was hard for me to complain because at the same time, you're like, everybody's being so nice to me. Like, I feel an unnatural degree of kindness from people who were just, you know, they're telling you, well, you've been part of my routine for years, so I want to be nice. And meanwhile, you know, like, imagine this. You were just sitting in your living room with a microphone in your hand, talking into it. And meanwhile, it made a difference to somebody else in a fucking faraway place. And once in a while, you actually get to understand what that is. When a person either tells you face-to-face or in a kind, heartwarming, and sometimes even shocking email that you get once in a while. But, you know, the perks of doing what I do have always contributed to the fact that I still do what I do, honestly. Like, if it wasn't for people sort of, you know, messaging me saying, you're the only thing that keeps me sane in my little Bible belt where no one understands me. Like, how can a person really, how can you deal with that knowledge and not feel, I don't know, simultaneously exalted and fearful, I suppose?
Yeah. I don't know. Day at a time, I suppose.
A day at a time. How many more questions we got, Chief?
What should I write down for the attitude of the employees and customers?
I think that the attitude of everybody has always been, like, almost universally positive. Like, everyone's always been ridiculously supportive. I mean, I've worked for when me and Ryan were doing when we were doing FightLinker together. I mean, there was a lot of negativity coming from there, but that was the nature of the site, you know. As opposed to Good Atheist, where even when I said that I was announcing that I was quitting, everyone was still very supportive of that, despite the fact that they didn't want me to do it. So I would say ridiculously supportive in everything I do.
Yeah. And I saved this one for last, even though it's number 13. Are you happy with your work? Why or why not?
Oh, well, you know, I would say that, I mean, I'm tremendously happy with what I do. I'm not always happy with the consequences of it. Mostly because, you know, like, anybody who chases a dream is going to fucking hate lots of parts of it, because it's going to suck. Like, what part of I aimed for my dream story do you hear where, you know, it's, and then everything went okay, and nothing bad happened? It's like, no, of course everything bad's going to happen. I mean, if I look at my situation, there are many things that make me miserable. As of right now, I'm still homeless, technically, doing what I wanted to do. Just because of the fucking realities of my situation and the advantages / disadvantages of being able to be anywhere. Well, guess what? Picked the wrong places, and that fucked me over. So those are unpleasant. But, you know, while those might get you down once in a while, I mean, I'm doing almost literally what I always dreamed I could do, which was something that was not easily describable, because how do you tell someone I wanted to think for a living? How do I describe this person what the fuck that means or how that's supposed to play out? Yeah, well, but here's the thing. I mean, to be a philosopher, what do you have to do? Essentially, you have to teach philosophy. You cannot be just a philosopher. I mean, maybe the lucky few who can write about it and make a living doing that, but there's not a lot. Almost everybody else has to have a fucking Joe job. And being paid to think is not generally something that a lot of people are able to do. So imagine my surprise where I'm like, well, as long as what I think I say on a recording, and then I try to sell people the idea that they need to listen to more of it, then maybe I can do this crazy thing. And so far, you know, it has been working. I mean, yeah, I hate to talk about numbers because they always seem so low, but I don't think anybody really understands that the internet is one of the hardest places to make money. And the fact that I have so many fucking fans that have paid, like, my turnaround is unbelievable. Like, it really is. Like, if it wasn't for the fact that so many people supported, we wouldn't be around. Like, the turnaround of most other programs that use freemium, like, let's say, Skype or Club Penguin or any of these other fucking places where most people go on for free and then a small percentage pays. I mean, I am literally 300 times, I have 300 times more people that subscribe than these guys. But because the numbers are just so small, it makes all the difference. Like, truth be told, you know, obviously this is impossible. But if I had 30,000 fans of the show rather than the full 4,000 that I say roughly represent the core group, and I had the turnaround that I did, I'd be making six figures a year. And it's all about the numbers. But I don't make six figures a year. I make, like, barely five, you know, like, it really does boil down to how many people actually get to listen to your shit and how much you sort of like believe, like, how much do I think to myself, is 4,000 the maximum that I can get? Is that the most of the peoples of the world that are going to listen to my fucking shit? I don't know. I don't think it's only 4,000. I think I can do better.
I think it's stupid that, you know, someone like you is doing this important podcast, and people are watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and they're making a few million a year. I just think that's ridiculous.
But don't you think, well, it would make sense, though, because think about, like, the Kardashians, they represent something that everybody is already familiar with, and, you know, like popularity, like the need to be desired, to be popular, to be rich. And that's something that everyone covets. And of course they'd have a large audience. I am the fucking bad news machine. I'm the guy that walks into your life and tells you, you need to do a lot more thinking. And that if you thought you were right about something, you might be wrong about it. And you need to question your fucking assumptions. Man, that is like, no one wants to hear that news. Nobody, like, who wants to be told that they are wrong? That's not a fucking nice thing to think about, dude. But, I mean, ultimately, if it's important, then few people are probably going to do it because there's no money into it. So I think that I only get to survive because, you know, there's no money into it right now. That's why I get to do it. So that was how many questions? Was that 13 questions in total?
23
questions, sorry. So we managed to go through it. That was, oh my God, almost 2 hours that people are going to go through. You mentioned that, oh, well, everyone's going to like a long show. Thank God it's a bonus show. Because I don't know if everyone's willing to put up with 2 hours of me going on and on about what I do. But here's the great thing. I thought this was a really good opportunity, not just for, well, you to do a science, a school project, but also for people to get an idea of what it is I do. Because I'm positive that no one has a fucking – I'm sure they just think, hey, you hit record and you put it out there and it's done, right? You're like, well, that and a billion other things. So I got to tell them through you, through a young fan. Okay, well, you know what? I'd like to thank Lincoln Rush and your school for this project. I hope that you don't get into trouble for it, and I hope you get a good mark for it altogether. Because, I mean, there's lots of jobs out there, but there are a few ones that are as weird and quirky as what I do. So hopefully they respond to that, your creativity and originality, positively, and not try to squash you and into conformity.
they've tried.
Well, you know, you sound indomitable, and I wouldn't be surprised if lots of the people who listen to the show give you a shout out and tell you that, listen, you're fighting the good fight. Like I said before, I mean, I talk fucking cheap. You are out there fucking dealing with that, and you're the courageous one, dude. So my hat's off to you. And now that I said that, you have to listen to my podcast forever because I complimented you. Right? We're understood?
I was going to anyway.
Sweet. All right. With that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Lincoln Rush.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody. Mm-hmm.